So today I'm welcoming back Luke Taylor to Radio Jackie. Welcome. You're the Liberal Democrat MP for Sutton and Cheam. You also have the role of Lib Dem spokesperson for London. So quite a big task on your hands. So let's go on to local transport funding. There's been a spending review. Do you think bus, tube and tram improvements are going to be put at risk? I understand people from Worcester Park have already been subject to an increase in fares by 20% and had their rail services cut, so the last train is coming much earlier now. How do you think further cuts would affect your constituency?
Further cuts would be utterly catastrophic, I think. So the figures that you gave, I raised in a question in Parliament. We've been contacted by a number of residents in Worcester Park. And the figures were that over the last 4 years, I think one of my constituents said that her season ticket had increased by 21% when she moved to Worcester Park. One of the reasons she moved there was you've got good access into central London. She was able to go out and use the nightlife with her friends, and then she'd be able to get train back just before 1 a.m. Now, that's well past my bedtime. But for young people who want to make the best of our nightlife, I think it's really important that you're able to socialise and get home safely and conveniently. But since she moved here, the last train's now well before midnight. And I think it highlights how we are really throttling the ability of our nighttime economy to attract customers, and for people to make the best of living in that outer London borough like Sutton. And I think this is true all around London. The question was, would further cuts impact us? Absolutely it would. If we have less frequency both late at night and in the peak hours, it's going to make Sutton less attractive to live. It's going to make people less likely to be able to get home to collect their kids, to be able to get to after school clubs, to be able to come home and rely on being able to be at home for evening meals. So that's a national rail question. And what I'm interested in seeing is how the nationalisation of the rail services leads to improvement in the reliability of services and in frequencies. That's the great British Rail project that the Labour government is embarking on. The nationalisation alone doesn't fix the problem. It's what they do with it that counts. I think you talked about local transport improvement. I'm quite disappointed to see that the London Mayor, Sadiq Khan's, only bid for or only asked for £250 million worth of funding from the government this year. We know the belts are tightened because of the disastrous Conservative government over the last few years. But what we need to make sure is that the Mayor is ambitious for London, that he's pushing for that increased funding, and that we're able to see the improvements in outer London, whether that's to the tram, whether it's to buses, whether it's to overground services. And again, now, not talking just about Sutton and Cheam, but across London, we need that improved late night and peak time services so that people are able to go out and use the nightlife. There was an alarming report this week, I think, that suggested that at the current rate of closures, London would see the last night out on New Year's Eve 2029, by which point all of our late night clubs and pubs would have closed. And that's at the current closure rates that the industry is experiencing. And that has to be down to the ease of accessing transport around London. And it is a really worrying aspect that our once great city that was well renowned for its nightlife is one of the reasons I moved down here for university from sleepy old Lincolnshire. But now I think I could probably find a better night out in Lincoln than I could in central London, which is a pretty depressing fact.
And the last thing you want are more cars on the road going into London.
Exactly. Oh, and that's the issue. And that's about reliability. There's, again, Worcester Park is a really good example of somewhere where you talk to residents who can't rely on a good rail service. So therefore, instead of getting the train from Worcester Park up to Wimbledon and around to Kingston and into town, they will now drive. And often they'll drive up to Surbiton or one of the other stations to then get into town. And that means you've got more cars on the road. Central Road through Worcester Park is one of the most polluted roads in London. We've got really unreliable bus service because of the levels of traffic. It's right on the edge of the ULEZ zone. So it's in exactly the area where the mayor has been really driving people to make more sustainable transport choices. But if the services aren't there, you can't rely on the trains, you can't rely on the buses, then it's just not going to pay off. And residents feel like they're being hammered and they're not given the options to make the choices that they're being pushed to make.
You've been campaigning for more training for police officers to deal with stalking. So, what do you think needs to be done in the light of many people are just asking for more bobbies on the beat? Do you think there's enough capacity in the force for both?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think you got there to the nub of the issue. People are pushing for more bobbies on the beat, but talking to the Metropolitan Police, what I think they want is flexibility in their hiring decisions. So they seem to have the budget. There's money there for officers, and I think there's a demand from the public and from politicians as well to see bobbies on the beat. But actually, quite often, what they need is people working behind the scenes, investigating crimes, and taking action to solve them. So yes, we want to see our safer neighborhoods teams fully recruited for. Yes, we want to see that friendly neighborhood police officer out and about, but then we need to have people working, checking evidence, collecting data, reviewing CCTV, which so often a complaint from people is that there's CCTV of these people committing crimes, but then it's not looked into, it's not requested by the police. And that's down to not enough staff. So I think what the police are calling for, and I think I would echo their calls, is to give them more flexibility in those hiring decisions. That makes sense to me. On stalking, the call came out of the London review of or the London Stalking Review published by the London Victims Commissioner, which suggested that 45% of stalking victims felt compelled to withdraw from the justice process. So they felt that they weren't going to get recourse. It was going to be not worth their time. And then 41% felt said that no action was taken on their complaints. So we've called for better training for officers because I think that approaching a really sensitive subject like this needs that specialist training. It needs that sensitivity for officers to act in an appropriate way for all victims, whether that's male or female, because I think there's a big problem with underreporting of male stalking victims. But I think we do need to acknowledge that the majority of stalking victims are women, and they do feel disenfranchised by the current Metropolitan Police. It was something that came up in the Casey report, and I think that we need to be really clear that those actions need to be followed through. And one of those ways to do that, and one of those ways for women to feel more trusted or find more trust in the police, is that specific training, sensitivity to deal with these really difficult cases, in a way that makes them feel like they're being listened to, and that their cases are being taken seriously.
It's like cases of domestic abuse. It's very similar. People are frightened to come forward and report domestic abuse, especially women and even men, because they don't think
Absolutely.
there's enough police time to look into their cases and to progress with them.
I think you're absolutely right. And until that trust is back in the police, then people won't come forward. And that is tragic. And that is a really upsetting prospect, that people feel like there's no point in engaging in the justice system. And therefore, justice is utterly denied to these people. And they may go on, or the perpetrators are more likely to go on and reoffend again and target more individuals, rather than if the complaints were dealt with seriously, then you would be able to take these people off the streets or, deal with the offending at the first instance.
Yeah, I think also a lot of PCSOs are converting to be full-time PCs. So there's a gap at the other end, at the PCSO end. And it's a sort of a different role, really. It's more of the role you'd expect when you see your bobbies on the beat, the PCSO role.
It is, and I think the numbers of PCSOs have dropped, but I think that that support role is important. The SNT officers are important, but again, it's not mutually exclusive that we're not recruiting on frontline roles. We're not recruiting PCSOs, and we're not recruiting safe labour teams. I think it's about giving the police the flexibility to hire where they feel appropriate.
So moving on, still on the police, in the light of the Chris Cabot case, if you were Mayor of London, would you have named the police officer, given that at the time Sadiq Khan and Yvette Cooper both pushed for this? Now the law has changed to give firearms officers anonymity. So how much scrutiny do you think firearms officers who are part of MO19 should have?
It's a really good question. I think there's a lot of emotion around this case this week. Clearly, the family of Chris Cabot are grieving. They have lost a son and a brother, and the community around him, already mistrustful of the police, now feels like their complaints or their mistrust in the police has been validated. I think when you look at the case in more detail, following the reporting restrictions being lifted, you view the video, I think it's an incredibly difficult situation to judge. I think personally, I mean, your question was, if I was Mayor of London, would I allow anonymity? I think I would. I think in this case, There is a lot of complexity around it, but I think that getting to a jury, allowing a jury to make a decision, in this country, it's something that we feel very strongly about, and it's the right way to go about. A jury of your peers judging you and your actions in a moment, were they appropriate? Were they lawful? Were your actions the right decision at the time? I think that the officer has clearly suffered from, and his family have suffered from, retribution and a lot of risk because of the reporting and because of some of the misinformation that was put out, I think, frankly. So I think what we need to do is, I think that anonymity is appropriate, but I think we need to be quite careful about the tone of the debate. And I think we need to be very, we need to acknowledge that lack of trust in the police, again, referring back to the case report, but also that in this case, a lot of information was only available to the public and to the press after the case was completed. And we need to review that with a calm eye, and avoid quite a lot of the very extreme statements that were made throughout the case, and immediately after the verdict was given.
Okay, moving on, just touching on the NHS funding issue again. How much headway have you made concerning the funding issues at St Raphael's Hospice? I know you're doing a lot of work in that area.
We are, and I mean, glad you've given me the opportunity to talk about it because it is an incredibly important case for my constituents, and I think more broadly in the hospice sector across London and the UK. So there's a couple of things that we've done since we last spoke. The first one is I met with Hospice UK in Parliament to talk to them about some of the trying to benchmark across different hospices to try and understand what has gone wrong with the funding at St Raph's. Why they seem to have such a disparity in their levels of funding compared to some of their peers. We've also tabled a bill. So the kind of using my position in Parliament, I have tabled a bill to be discussed on the 11th of July 2025 about putting together a more comprehensive and long-term funding settlement for hospices. And this would be an attempt to rationalise the existing process, which is very individual. It relies on a lot of kind of individual decisions to be taken on particular hospices. But I think the goal here, and it's a real buzzword that politicians use all the time, but it's to remove that postcode lottery. So in one particular area, you might have very high levels of funding for a hospice, and very good fundraising, and that's probably due to the demographics. So if that relatively wealthy area, you're likely to get higher donations. That means you might have much better hospice provision, which just isn't fair. We can't be having the situation where some residents have the luxury of, high quality care and others don't. So NHS England needs to come forward with a much fairer system of providing funding for hospices across the country. And that, I think, would be the solution to the challenges that St Raphs have, where we think that they are getting an unfair crack of the whip. And that then means that our local residents are being let down because they're not able to access the same level of care that residents in other areas would. That's the purpose of the bill. That's hopefully what we're going to try and make a case for over the next 9 months in preparation for the bill. We'll be doing publicity for that. We'll be talking about it as regularly as we possibly can. And hopefully we get the chance to bring a bill and hopefully get support for that. Now, we're not the government, but we want to act in a constructive way to suggest ways of doing things better. That's my job. That's the way I want to engage with the government, by suggesting kind of ideas that I hope they steal from me, and I hope they take away and implement themselves. And it will take, it's going to be a lot of work, but I think it's absolutely one of the biggest things that my residents tell me about. And that I see coming through my email inbox as well.
And with all your extra seats, 72, you're in a good position as a party to bring these things to the dispatch box, aren't you?
Yeah, we are, but in a sad way, it is that it affects so many of our other MPs as well. So talking to them in Parliament, and trying to work out who also shares these situations, it is sad that we will have that common ground with so many of my colleagues because it is quite widespread. There are the odd one or two whose situation is very, very different because they will have large bequests, they'll have particularly impressive fundraising teams. Where, and they are therefore, much more able to weather reductions in funding from NHS England. But broadly, the hospice sector is struggling and they need that long-term funding arrangement. They need that predictable income so they can plan their services and take the pressure off hospitals, allow people to come out of hospital and receive much more appropriate care. And it takes the pressure off elsewhere. So it's a win-win for everyone.
Absolutely. And finally, given that the Secretary of State for Health, Wes Streeting, has stated that end of life and palliative care in the NHS is very poor, are you going to vote with him in the vote for assisted dying that's coming up on the 29th of November? Because he's actually voting against the bill.
He is, and I broadly I do understand his position. So he did vote in favour of an end of life bill the last time it came to Parliament, and his position now is that because he is responsible for delivering palliative care and funding for, he said that he doesn't feel it's appropriate for him to vote for an alternative, and I completely understand his position there. My personal view is that end of life care is about choices. That's why I'm putting so much energy into campaigning for funding for hospices, because it's about giving people choices whether they want to have their end of life care being given in a hospice, in a hospital. But similarly, I feel that it is right to give people a choice if it comes to how they manage the end of their life. As a liberal, it's about giving choice to people. It's about enabling people to make decisions for themselves. I think that so many people are put in really difficult positions today, seeing loved ones going through unimaginable pain, where no level of palliative care, no level of pain relief is enough. And as a liberal, it's about giving people choices. So for me, I'm probably very likely to vote in favour. I will need to look at the legislation. We do need to make sure that it protects doctors, that it protects the disabled, that it doesn't scope the scope doesn't creep into some of the areas that we see in other countries. I don't think the model in Canada, in Europe, is the right one to go by. I think what we talk about in the Liberal Democrats is the Oregon model, which is where it is only for terminal illness with a prognosis of less than 6 months. Others would push for a wider bill, but I think it is appropriate to wait to see the legislation. But I think I'm probably minded to vote in favour because of that ability to give people choices to take control of their own lives, and in this case, the end of their lives.
Yeah, it's, I mean, they say the bill is about shortening the process of dying, not shortening the process of
Exactly.
life. But there's
That's a
some
really
people,
good way to put it.
yeah, but some people are saying, okay, you've got 6 months to live. And then, with cancer, sometimes you can go into some sort of spontaneous remission and you might be
Oh,
depriving of
absolutely.
them of that extra life.
But you're not depriving them if they're making the choice themselves. It's giving that individual the ability at the appropriate moment. And I think this is lost in the debate sometimes, that nobody is forcing an individual to make these choices. For me, it is utterly about enabling the individual to make the appropriate decision. And there are safeguards. I think in what the Liberal Democrat position on end of life choices is about having two doctors. So you do have a higher level of confidence that that diagnosis is correct. I think there are all sorts of worries about how that legislation might look in the end. But for me, it is entirely about giving an individual, and I would want that choice. I would want to give my parents that choice. And I've heard a number of individuals come to meetings that I've been at and talk about not only their choices, but seeing their parents go through cases where they were desperate and they had been denied the ability to choose the way they pass. And as a liberal, it's about enabling people to take appropriate choices. But again, at the same time, my passion is about providing the best care and the choices to people. And if that is in a hospice, I want to make sure those hospices are funded, that they're able to be looked after in their own home, and they choose not to make other choice, to choose not to take a palliative case or an end of life case. It's about providing people that dignity and that ability as they see fit to live their life and choose the end of their life.
Do you think it's going to put more pressure on our already pressurised GPs? I know you've been speaking to the GPs in Sutton and Cheam, and they're saying they're under huge pressure. They're having to triage patients so that they can concentrate on the more urgent cases. Isn't this going to put more pressure on them?
It's a really good question. I know that it is likely to put more pressure on doctors and kind of surgical doctors who give that prognosis on terminal cases. I think that GPs will no doubt see an additional demand as they get involved in the primary care point. It is going to be a balance. We are going to need to provide enough resources in the system, but for me, it's about kind of an individual choice element, and then the resource question will have to be looked at later on. But it's a very good point to raise.
Thank you, Luke. Well, thank you. I'll let you go now. Thank you for our discussion this afternoon. I look forward to catching you after the budget because there'll be lots more to talk about, I'm sure.
There will be, I'm sure there will be thousands of things to talk about. So yeah, and it'll be nice to actually have certainty over things. I mean, for so many years we've struggled with lack of certainty, with unreliable spending plans, with broken promises on local hospitals, for example. So following the budget, look, I'm really excited to be able to kind of have a bit of certainty about a lot of things. And hopefully this government will have listened to local politicians and local residents over what we need to see in that budget. And hopefully it's kind of a bit of light at the end of the at the end of the tunnel.
We need a bit of light, don't we? Thank you again. Have a lovely afternoon or enjoy your weekend. And thank you for coming on to Radio Jackie again to talk to me.